like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. And my guest today is Dr. Ann Weaver, an animal behaviorist and expert on bottlenose dolphins who's been conducting a long-term conservation-based study not far from here, examining the impact on 350 bottlenose dolphins before, during, and after the Johns Pass Bridge project involving an important dolphin thoroughfare. Over the course of her work, echoing the research methods of such prominent fellow animal behaviorists as Jane Goodall, Cynthia Moss, and Diane Fossey, Weaver has photographed the dolphins extensively using close-ups of their fins to identify and distinguish them. We'll find out about Dr. Weaver's background and other previous studies, some details of the current study, including its implications, and more when we speak with Dr. Ann Weaver in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Right now, I think we'll do something we haven't done in a while. Play an animal song in the early part of the show. This one was brought to my attention by the fabulous Flea, host of the Monday It's the Music, and WNF's music director, of course. It's brand new music from the Bottle Rockets with a song called Dog on Talking Animals.
I love my dog, he's my dog. If you don't love my dog, that's okay. I don't want you to, he's my dog. I love my dog, he's my dog. If my dog don't love you, that's okay. I don't want him to, he's my dog. Sometimes it's just this simple. Sometimes life is just this simple. Sometimes life is really just this simple. I love my dog. I love my dog, he's my dog. If my dog don't love you, that's okay. I don't want him to, he's my dog. I love my dog, he's my dog. If you don't love my dog, that's okay. I don't want you to, he's my dog. Sometimes it's just this simple. Sometimes life is just this simple. Sometimes life is really just this simple. I love my dog. I don't want you to, he's my dog.
That's new music from the Bottle Rockets with a song called, that's right, Dog. Right now, let's hear my conversation with Dr. Weaver, recorded a couple of Thursdays ago. This is Dr. Ann Weaver on Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Weaver. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
I'm keenly interested in learning more about bottlenose dolphins, especially your research on a particular local community of bottlenose dolphins. But I'd like to first find out a bit about you, starting with which came first, an academic interest in dolphins or a personal one?
Academic interest in dolphins came first. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and we didn't have a lot of dolphins there, so I didn't discover them until my adulthood.
And by what means did you discover them at that point?
And number of times in my life, without my trying, I got an opportunity to work with them.
Without your trying? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Oh, so you accidentally had an opportunity to hang out and work with dolphins?
I was given opportunities by a number of different individuals a number of different times, and the fifth time an opportunity almost fell in my lap, I decided that I would run with it. And that's resulted in our 10-year intensive study we're in the middle of now.
And, of course, we'll delve into that in some detail in a moment. But that's really interesting. So it sounds like you were doing other things with other kinds of animals, I guess, ostensibly. And then the dolphin thing kind of kept surfacing, is that, as it were. Is that pretty much?
It's a great pun. It is perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way it happened was that I was looking for a master's in animal behavior, and an opportunity came up. The professor had a slot on a boat, needed a student, and offered me the spot. And I had self-trained in animal behavior techniques, if you will, up to that point. So I thought, although dolphins are very difficult, probably the most difficult animal to study in their wild state, I needed a project, so I would do it. So I wrote and illustrated a dictionary of dolphin behavior called an ethogram, which gave me a vocabulary to use. So now when we're out there at sea seeing dolphins, I can almost dictate to you what's happening with a series of terms that I use consistently from the dictionary that I did way back when in California.
I'm curious, what sort of animals or what sort of work or research had you been doing prior to this opportunity where the professor said, hey, we need someone, and how about you joining us on the boat?
I had discovered when I was a freshman in college that the field of animal behavior had my name on it. So because at the time Jane Goodall and other professionals like her were out in the fields and not developing as much fame as they have now, there weren't any ways to formally train yourself in animal behavior except to work with animals. So that's what I did. I took a very pragmatic approach. If there was an opportunity to do a job with an animal, I took it. So I did a variety of things. I was either a public educator at a zoo, animal handler at a zoo, worked in pet stores, had the fortune of being able to work in a very exotic pet store, which now we wouldn't allow because they were getting animals from the wild in ways we don't approve of anymore. But it did give me exposure to monkeys and parrots, a variety of reptiles, a variety of very exotic animals.
Where was that store?
That particular pet store was in the Chicagoland area,
okay,
in Illinois.
Okay.
We wouldn't have a pet store like that anymore. It wouldn't be legal way back when, before the Animal Protection Acts in the early 70s came to the fore.
Sure.
People were still importing ruthlessly. I worked for the Department of Agriculture in their Animal and Health Plant Inspection Service. They were still importing birds at the time, so I worked with thousands of exotic birds, all of it with the idea of figuring out what is this thing called animal behavior? How do you study it?
So it really sounds like, at that period, any sort of opportunity to be exposed to animals and their behavior, regardless, I mean, you didn't have a specific mission or like, hey, I particularly want to work with cats or parakeets or whatever. It's like, I just want to accumulate as much knowledge to just keep advancing down the road of animal behavior.
And, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd become familiar with the science of ethology, knew that was what I wanted to do, never deviated from the path of ethology or animal behavior. And all animals behave. So every single one of them was admissible in my adventure.
So that was kind of the prelude to when the opportunity came along that this professor offered you to jump on the boat and help with the dolphin project.
Exactly. I knew that higher education was also in my future because there are a lot of ways to work with animals, and I wanted to be able to study them. And in order to do that in our particular time and space in society, you have to have a higher degree to do that or to be considered credible doing it. So I always knew that I would get a PhD. It was just a matter of when and how.
Let me sort of trace that path a little bit further. So the dolphin project that we discussed was when you were in the midst of or as part of working on a master's in animal behavior, as I recall.
Yeah.
And so then from there, what was the path to the PhD and what was the focus of your doctoral thesis?
I'm an unusual academic, Duncan, because I'll go get a degree, go back to work, go get a degree, go back to work, go get a degree, go back to work. I believe in practical research. Somebody has to benefit tomorrow at work from the work I do today with respect to research. So when I finished my master's with the dolphins in California, I went to work and then went back for a PhD later at Emory, where I studied primates.
Mm.
And I'm interested in the development of behavior, how development emerges in the life of an individual. So I was able to study monkeys in a captive environment to watch them grow up. And at that time, I answered the question, how do you learn to apologize? And the monkeys were my subject, so I watched 38 kid monkeys grow up, wrote down every time they fought, wrote down everything that happened after that, and that trained my eye for fast-acting behavior, taking data at the speed of light, and then got me my PhD. Did that, I was able to return to dolphins.
So let me just back up for a sec to make sure I understood. The thing that you were recording at the speed of light there with the animal behavior on these primates was learning how they learned to apologize to each other? Is that?
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. So when they've had some sort of fight or misbehavior amongst themselves, what your project was documenting how they make that up, how they apologize, how people get over it and move on?
Right. Now, this, I used a monkey model. Monkeys grow up faster. They do not change their behavior when you watch them. Mm. So those are perfect characteristics for a species that you want to study in terms of conflict resolution. People are very tough to study in a naturalistic setting because they're too self-conscious of being observed. Yeah, but that's what I did. I asked the question, how do you learn to apologize, and what happens if you don't learn to apologize?
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Yeah,
it was. It was a long-term intensive, just like my dolphin project, not as long, but very intensive in terms of data collection and analysis. And the answer is, well, you learn part of it from the way your mother treats you.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, that sounds very familiar. Yeah, but, yeah. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Ann Weaver, a behaviorist who has spent much of her career studying bottlenose dolphins. This conversation was recorded last Thursday. So in a moment, Doctor, we will ask you to describe your methods for identifying and naming, I guess, really, too, the dolphins that you study, especially given that this represents over the course of the study, I think, some 300 and some odd dolphins. But along those very lines, I'm curious what sort of behaviorists or other scientists, for that matter, particularly inspired you. Earlier in the conversation, you mentioned Jane Goodall. Were there others that you particularly thought, okay, what they've done and the kind of work they've done, especially studying behavior of a given animal, is something I'd like to emulate myself in my work?
I really admire the behaviorists or biologists that have gone into the natural environment, learned how to exist in the world that the animal they are studying exists in, and studies their naturally occurring behavior without disrupting it to the extent that they can manage that.
Yeah.
So Jane Goodall and a number of other women have pioneered that ability and served as role models for us. Galdikas did it with orangutans, Diane Fossey with gorillas. There have been a number of other people that have come through in the last several decades who use that technique, and those are the people that I admire.
As we're just talking about this, because a couple of that come to mind that deal with elephants would be like Cynthia Moss and Andrea Turcolo and others. So it's interesting, just as another conversation for another time, but it's interesting that those are all these kind of key figures in this world are all women. Okay, so you got your doctorate, and then shortly after that, did you say, okay, now I'm coming back to dolphins?
I had another opportunity offered to me to work with dolphins in the wild, and so I took it and had an opportunity to find out what it's like to try and collect data when you're actually swimming with wild dolphins, which is very, very challenging.
Wow.
And my hat's off to the people that do that. It's very, very tough. You have to be an Olympic-level athlete and a scientist at the same time. So I tried that, and it taught me another layer of how to think about dolphins. And then an opportunity came into my own life to have my own project, my own boat, my own permit, my own whole nine yards with the project I'm working on now. And a practical applied project in terms of determining whether some human activities constitutes an anthropogenic threat against a community of wild dolphins. And so, you know, that, as they say, is that. And that was in 2004 where I began and we've been working on it ever since.
Just to back up briefly for 1 second, then I want to forge ahead for sure. Where was the project based that involved collecting data while swimming with the dolphins that you were involved with?
There is an area of the world in which dolphins are habituated to human swimmers, but we're often asked not to disclose that.
Ah, okay. All right. So that's as much as you can say. Okay. All right.
Fair enough. That's to the benefit of the dolphins.
Yeah. Yeah, if you told me more, you'd have to kill me, probably, it sounds like that to me, right? Okay, so let's really get into the current project, or current over a long period of time already. So explain more specifically what you're examining, and also maybe explain the Johns Pass Bridge here. For those of us that aren't familiar with it or don't live in that area, wouldn't really know, have a picture of what that looks like and what the areas and waterways around that are.
The study area doesn't encompass, like you just said, Duncan, what's called Johns Pass. It's a narrow corridor of water connecting the Gulf of Mexico to the Intracoastal Waterway, which is a river of sea, partly man-made, partly natural, that serves as an ideal habitat for bottlenose dolphins. In 2006, they began a construction project replacing the bridge that spanned Johns Pass, which itself is a watery corridor. So we were in a good position to do what's called a before, during, and after study of the bridge construction project. So we were able to go out and begin the study before construction began to familiarize ourselves with the dolphins that used the local waters, the waters around the construction site. Then during construction, we were able to monitor the same waters, and now then after construction ended 5 years later, we were able to continue. So the benefit of that before, during, and after design is that you get baseline data. What is going on before this particular coastal construction project? And then it enables you to look during and after to see whether there were changes. It's really critical to any conservation study to have baseline data when you're looking at something that could pose an impact. So that made it a very valuable study. So we were able to secure a study area. Of course, a federal permit is required to do this kind of work. Identify a study area, get a small boat, and start going out and monitoring the dolphins well before construction started. So it's a very important approach and consideration for those of us interested in human impact and natural wild populations, because you have to know what was going on before the human impact, if that's what it was, began.
In each of those phases, and maybe it's the same throughout each of those phases, what methods do you employ to really establish sort of that baseline and then see what the impact is as the construction project got underway and was going?
We asked 4 basic questions. How many animals are there? Dolphins. Where are the dolphins? What are the dolphins doing? And what kind of physical condition are they in? So to do that, we take a small boat and go over a survey route of the intercoastal waterway and cover it the same way every time we do a survey. We go out to sea at the same time each time, cover the same stretch of water the same way each time. Each time we encounter dolphins, we stop and we take data the same way each time. So we're trying to take information in and as consistent a way as possible so that any changes that we see across time in the database are not our doing from data collection procedures, but are the animals themselves.
Right.
And bottlenose dolphins are notoriously variable. They are very difficult to predict because they're on some sort of time zone, time frame that defies either a diurnal pattern, nocturnal pattern, or crepuscular pattern, those animals that are active, dawn and dusk.
And you, earlier in the conversation, talking about a different study, but I found it interesting that you noted that dolphins you found are notoriously difficult to study just generally.
Yeah.
And why, what makes them so?
Well, the biggest argument against natural studies of dolphin behavior at sea is the fact that you don't see them the majority of the time. So you could say, well, how can you understand the behavior of an animal that only surfaces to breathe and is therefore visible from a boat, say, 5% of the time? My counter to that, Duncan, is there's a billion-dollar industry called the fishing industry, and they never see the fish whose behavior they're studying in order to be a good fisherman. So it's very possible to understand a great deal about what's going on with animals under the water surface without being able to see them.
Yeah.
But the bottlenose dolphins are air breathers. They bring their activities and their current behavior state to the surface with them when they breathe. So you can study it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You do miss a great deal, and it's to our regret that the water isn't clear and we can't see 100% of everything, but that is the way most natural waterways are.
And speaking of natural waterways, so the area you're studying seems to be a particularly attractive spot to the dolphins, and you probably wouldn't be conducting research there if they weren't there. So I'd be interested to know why they find it so attractive. Is it the conditions of the water, the depth, the temperature? Are there other factors why there is that sort of population, you know, in that area in particular?
I think every one of the characteristics you listed, Duncan, is correct. The depth of the water ranges as perhaps, you know, in pockets it'll be 20 feet deep, but other than that, it's about a 10 or 12 foot deep pool, which varies with the tides. It's generally speaking warm. This is a semi-tropical environment. There's good currents. There's lots of food because it's an estuary. So bottlenose dolphins like all those characteristics. What makes our study area particularly rich are two things. Number one, it's got the pass to the Gulf of Mexico, so it kind of serves as a grand central station. But number two, it has about a third or more of natural coastline. So a great deal of the coastal areas where you find bottlenose dolphins are very attractive to people, and they have hardened the coastline with seawalls. That's unnatural. The natural coastline is something like a sandbar, a little beach. So a great deal of the study area that we've chosen is natural coastline, and we think that that's fundamental to attracting the animals here.
And also the location, just from video and photographs and stuff I've seen, it looks like that there are folks kind of who live nearby and people regularly in the area on boats. You're obviously regularly in the area on a boat. How habituated to humans have these dolphins become over time, given all that sort of human activity?
I think that we can say they're quote-unquote urban dolphins. This is an area where people boat regularly throughout the year. It is not as crowded as other places in Florida. The number of boats on the waterways on a regular basis makes a difference to dolphins. I studied dolphins in five places in the world, and they have been graded, Duncan, in terms of the number of boats on them. So, for example, off San Diego, there's beautiful breakers and very few boats. In the Sea of Cortez, there are even fewer boats. In contrast, you go to North Carolina, and there's boats every 20 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see, if you study dolphins in different environments, that the boat traffic does make a difference. Where it's very crowded with boats, number one, you're going to have a very tough time finding dolphins because they will ultimately be discouraged from their habits and move elsewhere or just disappear, and they will be very difficult to approach. So boating is a big issue with respect to dolphins, and it depends on how an area's boaters behave. You know, if they follow the dolphins relentlessly versus stop and look at them for a couple minutes and then continue on, as well as the number of boats that there are. A big impact.
Yeah, on a related note, just because if you've been out in a boat one place or another where dolphins hang out or can hang out, they do often, curious, they approach the boat, they like to ride the wake, whatever it might be. So I imagine, at least, especially over the years, a number of them must routinely approach your boat. How do you handle that as a researcher? I mean, well, you know, I assume you don't really want to directly interact with them. You want to observe them and make notes and take pictures, but does that get tricky at all? Or?
Great question. I have been paying particular attention to that ever since this started. You want to habituate the dolphins to you, any animals that you study. In other words, communicate to them somehow that I am going to come and watch you for a period of time. Do not let that frighten you. But at the same time, you don't want to befriend them, and so we don't play with them or anything else. But the dolphins have made it clear that they certainly understand our presence. We are very predictable so that they know what we're going to do. My boat captain, Captain John Heidemann, extremely gifted and experienced when it comes to handling a boat around the dolphins. So the dolphins know exactly what we're going to do. They make a decision about whether they'll be near the boat. One thing to think about is that the dolphins are aware of our approach many minutes before we see them because of their incredible hearing. So it's uncanny to consider that they may make an active choice, and I think sometimes they do make an active choice about whether we will see them or not.
So in other words, are you saying that they know you're coming before you get there because of their hearing, but they know specifically the sound of your boat as opposed to some other person's boat that might be coming out that day? Is it that precise, or is it kind of hard to...
We think so. I mean, dolphins, like all sea animals, live in a world of sound. They have refined it beyond our capacity to even measure their refinement level.
Yeah.
And every boat's going to have its own acoustic signature, you know, the design of it, the engine it's coupled with, how old it is, etc. So we think it's fair to suggest that each boat has its own acoustic signature, and like traffic, most of it probably blends into the background for the dolphins, but if you know your husband or wife's car, I mean, my bird knows our car is coming down the street, so it's likely that they know the sound of our boat, and we try and be a very predictable entity around them. The most important, I think, field technique is that because dolphins are so smart, we have tried very hard to communicate to them that our observational schedule is at their whim, if you will.
Yeah.
So if a dolphin, we read their body language, their personal distance, and their flight distance, so how far away a dolphin will allow us to come or approach. If we see indications that there is a particular distance, say a 3 or 4 boat length distance, say 60, 80 feet, that's what we maintain in terms of the distance. And if they're evading you but wish to continue with what they're doing without your presence, you can read that in their behavior. If they want to evade you completely, they will.
Sure.
They will just ditch you. So I think that's a very fine science, communicating to intelligent animals. We would like to observe you for a while. Is that going to work for you? And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Their behavior has remained wild. Become used to our routine, but they still give us plenty of demonstrations that they are wild dolphins who are by no means beholden to us in any way like that.
So this kind of brings me then, Dr. Weaver, to, by the way, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is behaviorist Dr. Ann Weaver, and we're discussing her research over many years on bottlenose dolphins. This conversation was recorded last Thursday. Dr. Weaver, what drew you to studying, in particular, the impact on the dolphins before, during, after, as you've noted, this coastal construction in this area? I mean, was there something that, an initial premise that you thought, okay, let's really chart this to determine what?
If there's any change in any of the measures that we take on the dolphins that could indicate whether or not bridge construction was any kind of threat to them. So an anthropogenic threat is a man-made threat. And there's a tremendous amount of coastal construction going on in the United States and across the world. It's very difficult and expensive to answer the question, does that hurt the animals under the construction site? Because you have to have baseline data to know how many animals were there and what they did before the construction, and that's rarely available. You have to have some sort of heads up, and you don't find out about construction as a rule until it started. So the question was, is there any obvious change in the dolphins' behavior contingent on the before, during, and after phases of our research? In other words, we were able to publish a decline in the resident female dolphins with respect to the construction project. So my thoughts on it are that old habits die hard, but if you disrupt the environment long enough, sufficiently enough, you can discourage animals who've lived there for X number of years or decades from using that area as much or at all. So the idea is that with, I think, these larger animals, they don't just disappear one day in a fell swoop. We slowly but surely make conditions incompatible with what they need, and they'll slowly disappear. And then 20 or 30 years down the line, you go, gee, there used to be so many dolphins around here. What happened?
And to flip that around then, Dr. Weaver, is part of the intent of the study to have the opposite thing happen? In other words, say, hey, we have a construction project pending in such and such an area in 2019 or, you know, whatever it might be. And if we apply some of the findings from this study of yours to how we execute that construction project, we can have less disruption on the environment because of what we've learned over time in this one, this Jones Pass one?
Yes, that would be an ideal outcome. In other words, is there a time of year it's better to schedule these things? Is there some sort of illumination level we can consider? Because there's a trickle-down effect. Whatever happens at the immediate construction site, when we're talking marine construction, such as a bridge over a waterway, that would be the ultimate goal, would be to identify things that could mitigate some impacts. First, we have to understand what, if any, impacts there are.
So, obviously, this is a long-term study that's still underway. What are the notable findings so far, especially relative to what you might have expected to find?
The most notable finding so far is that the individuals in the community who are responsible for reproducing that community, the resident females, have shown a statistically significant decline. So, you're still seeing dolphins, but you are not seeing as many. And you are not seeing the same ones. This suggests that some animals may have moved into spots vacated by resident animals. Part of the work we're doing now is to see if that decline reverses itself. And this is an essential feature. If you want to disrupt an animal population, make sure it doesn't reproduce itself in a steady state, and pretty soon you will have very successfully disrupted that community.
When you say that the resident females, there's been a decline, but what might reverse itself, does that mean that because the construction is completed and the things that ostensibly at least probably cause them to leave, once that's those noise, those disruptions, those things that bothered them have been ended, that then there's reason to hope that they would come back, or at least others would not leave in the same way?
That's what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. Dolphins have large home ranges, but most of them can be conceptualized as living in a particular area. Now, they don't live in a certain bay. You can't go find a dolphin on demand, but there is an area that they can generally be found in. There's also good evidence that there are animals that move through sort of like transients, and animals that will visit on a regular basis like reliable tourists. There are a lot of different levels of residency, but the idea being that what exactly happens when you disrupt an environment for 5 years and you have long-term intelligent animals with very flexible habits? Is the model that we're able to generate from this project going to be transferable to other bottlenose dolphins and or any other animal species? Bottlenose dolphins are unique in that they're long-lived, large-brained, have an extremely flexible lifestyle, as we talked about before. So it may be that they are fairly unique in their response to it. And the problem, of course, another problem with doing practical study, conservation studies in the wild, is that we'll never be able to demonstrate irrevocably that the decline was associated with the bridge construction. All we can say is this happened at the same time. So you always have, you know, an element of doubt. Doesn't mean such research isn't important.
So, Dr. Weaver, then, I guess I'm curious, is there a projected timetable for the study? In other words, is there an end date from then you'll say, we have ended it at this point after the construction, so here is now, within the framework of the before, during, and after, this is what we really found, and here's the conclusions we've drawn.
I will continue with the study, although the pieces of information, you know, year by year by year, can be subdivided as we look to see what we've actually found. At this point, our immediate reason for continuing it is that now we have documented a decline. Does that decline show any signs of changing? If so, which direction? And if it does, how did that happen? If it doesn't, what happens now? Yeah. So the next piece is, all right, are the ladies that left going to come back?
Based on your experience and various other studies you've done, what would be your guess? Will they come back?
We're starting to see some interesting suggestions that maybe that's the case. So it does remain to be seen. And in the meantime, what makes it so incredibly interesting is that you can put together a number of other puzzle pieces that play into it. So if there's a decline in females over a five-year period, some of those females will be lost to natural causes. So it brings in questions of the longevity of animals at sea, perhaps some causes of death of animals at sea, calf survival, whether that was affected, et cetera. Who actually lives there? What constitutes a resident dolphin? You know, it continually unfolds like a rose that never stops unfolding its petals.
Sure.
So interesting.
So over the course of the study, how many dolphins, because I know obviously for you to really establish what the impact has been before, during, and after, you really have to know who's who in the dolphin world there. So how many dolphins have you identified and recorded, photographed, otherwise kept track over the years?
At this point, we're at 350, and that has emerged from about 120 the first year, at about 11% increase over time. A lot of years, those new dolphins are babies that are born here. So we tell them apart by the dorsal fin on their back that appears when they surface to breathe, which, to our good, our good fortune, will get tattered over time and allows us to have a unique pattern on a great percent of the animals. A unique pattern that identifies the fin, and that, with some exceptions only, stays pretty consistent over time. So I look at those fins like faces.
Wow. So when you're out in the boat, a dolphin is out there, or you're looking in binoculars, and you'll say, hey, there's so-and-so, like just instantly, the way a friend and I might see each other in the hall and say, hey, so-and-so. I mean, it's that immediate and that clear to you?
Yes. Yeah, I would say 99% of the time, I can tell you within a short period of time who it is. And then I can tell you what I've learned about them over the last 10 years. So it's been interesting because it is a knowledge you gain one animal at a time. I think if someone stepped into a 350 dolphin database, tried to learn it, it would be overwhelming. But when you do it one at a time and you're profoundly interested in it, it's easier. It is not easy to study wild dolphins. It takes patience, persistence.
So as long as it's something that begins with the letter P, it seems to require that. So yeah. Doctor, we were sort of ending the near of our time, but just a couple other quick questions. How is the dolphin study funded?
We have a variety of sources. I have a consulting service that proceeds from which go directly into our marine boat. We are fortunate to have generous donors, and so we have been able to maintain our project at a pretty good clip over time with that. Are you going to help me with some group sourcing and group funding?
Sorry, am I encouraging something? Is that what you said? Well, so
yeah.
Here's a related question, because I know you're sort of alluding to your statistical consulting firm, Good Natured Statistics, and so there is a website for that, goodnaturedstatistics.com, so you can see some dolphins there. But, I mean, is there some other online presence that people could go to find out more about what we've been discussing here, the study, some of the dolphins that you know and can easily identify, et cetera, or is that website at the moment kind of the place to see at least what you do post?
The goodnaturedstatistics.com website is a good place to go, because from there it can connect you to over 400 articles that I have published on dolphin behavior.
Yeah.
That are online through the Tampa Bay newspaper. So that is a very good place to go in terms of fairly light reading, but 100% accurate on what really goes on at sea. So that's a great source to start with.
Perfect. All right. Well, Dr. Weaver, I think we have kind of reached the end of our time. We've been speaking with Dr. Ann Weaver. Again, the website, as she's just noted, to find out all kinds more the details of the things we've been discussing here, is goodnaturedstatistics.com. So, Dr. Weaver, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, and we'll check back with you to find out more of the after as it unfolds.
Duncan, we all appreciate the work you do. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Our thanks again to Dr. Ann Weaver. Can never really go wrong when we're stepping into the Comedy Corner by doing so with Jim Gaffigan. And I thought today we'd stretch out with a longer and typically wonderful piece by him. This is Jim Gaffigan with a piece called Eat Vegetarian in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I'm a vegetarian now. Anyone a vegetarian? Yeah, there you go. I'm not a strict vegetarian. I eat beef and pork. And chicken, but not fish, because that's disgusting. How can you tell when fish goes bad? It smells like fish either way. Well, this smells like a dumpster. Let's eat it. No one really likes fish. They just won't admit it. Like, I like fish just as long as it doesn't taste like fish. I got news for you. I don't think you like fish. I'm almost positive fish is supposed to taste like fish. Actually, you know what's really good on fish? Anything that kills the taste of fish. How about relish in a gallon of mayo? That'll do the job. What if we squeeze a lemon and wrap it in seaweed and cover it in soy sauce? He's anti-fish. And we're right next to Lake Michigan. I am amazed that we're still serving fish with the heads on there. Don't you always feel like that eye's looking at you like, hey, you don't mind if I watch while you eat my body, do you? Don't be distracted, a little tear comes out. You can just tell yourself it's butter. Oh, what if a fish was in the audience? That would be awkward for all of us. It could happen. Lake Michigan's right there, buddy. The fish would laugh, but on the inside it'd be crying. Sad. You and your fish head joke. Obviously, some people prefer it like that. Y'all have the fish. Keep the head on there and find out if it had a nickname.
Anywho.
Pig roast, yeah. Pig roast, we always have that pig head sitting there, which is sad, because you can tell they killed the pig when it was eating an apple. Hey, pig, you want an apple? Sure, what are you doing with that spear? Ow! Mid-bite every time. At least those animals aren't alive, yeah. I was feeling uncomfortable when I go in a seafood restaurant, they have that lobster tank sitting there, all the lobsters are peering out like, hey, what are you here for?
I'm here to eat you.
Yeah, right. Hey, Harvey, this guy. Harvey? Oh, and Harvey was gone. My niece is 9 years old. She informed me she's a vegetarian. I would love to have pulled that when I was a kid. No thanks, Dad. I'm a vegetarian. No son of mine's gay. Eat your meat, pussy. His dad sounded scary. You ever eat fast food in front of a vegetarian? They look at it like you're barbecuing a kitten. Oh my God, you're eating that? Yeah, and I'm not gonna digest it for a decade. Come along with me. I do love the vegetarians. I always get a kick out of when they try and impress you. They're like, I haven't had meat in 5 years. I haven't had a banana in a month. You see me bragging about it. You know what they do to those chickens? No, but it's delicious. Don't get me wrong, I love animals. I just love to eat them more. Fun to pet, better to chew. I do feel bad they have to be killed. I prefer it was like an animal suicide. Maybe the animal deserved it. You know, this is a good chicken sandwich. Think this bastard tried to steal my car. Good work, Roger. Who's Roger? I was just getting used to Harvey. I don't know who some of these people are.
That was, of course, Jim Gaffigan with a piece called Eat Vegetarian, taken from his CD, Beyond the Pale. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity rolling into the noon hour. Constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more with contributions from members of the stellar WNF staff. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a fabulous Talking Animals t-shirt. You know you want it. It has Charles Darwin on the cover. Or on the front, I guess I should say. Anyway, right now it's time for some animal news and announcements. And I meant to get to this last week, but we had a sort of a jam-packed show with a long interview with Richard Kudo and then a nice shorter interview with Gretchen Primack, and we're reading one of her new poems, specifically about Thanksgiving. So I didn't get to really any animal news and announcements last week. So one of the things, of course, that came up last week was the news that was first reported early last week. I think the San Diego Union Tribune was the first to break it, saying that SeaWorld had decided to cancel its orca shows, at least in the San Diego SeaWorld, beginning next year. So the newspaper that reported that went on to say it wouldn't, traditional show wouldn't be abandoned altogether. It would be replaced with one that is less, quote, less about tricks and more about orcas' natural behaviors in the wild. So Blackfish director Gabriella Cowperthwaite, of course a past guest on Talking Animals, weighed in saying, "I've been anxiously awaiting details on SeaWorld's plans. I am always optimistic when I hear that there is some semblance of change, but it appears they are not stopping their orca shows at all, just repurposing them. I'm afraid this is just the latest attempt to survive the PR nightmare that is SeaWorld," Cowperthwaite said in a statement to The Hollywood Reporter. "And after all this time, I almost bought it. But then again, we all bought into the myth of the happy Shamu for 50 years. Spin has always been their greatest strength, but until they stop breeding and retire their whales into sea sanctuaries, we just can't let up. Nothing else they're doing truly changes anything for the animals. Just makes us feel better about watching the shows." Couldn't agree more. The only other thing I would add is that part of the SeaWorld announcement, when they talked about the alternative orca exhibit, was that it would have a conservation emphasis. So anyone that's listened to this show or paid much attention to the animal welfare world knows that conservation, especially when it comes to zoos and aquatic parks, etc., is a red flag that usually means somebody's trying to sell you some sort of bill of goods. Conservation really can't happen in those environments. I mentioned this a few times in past shows, but now it's coming up tonight, in fact. The First United Church of Tampa will be hosting a showing and discussion of Cowspiracy, the great documentary we featured on Talking Animals some time ago with the filmmakers. Anyways, this will be, again, tonight, November 18th at 6:45 p.m. at the church on East Fowler in Temple Terrace. Again, that being the First United Church of Tampa. This Saturday, November 21st, the Humane Society of Tampa Bay, the Thanksgiving-themed event, will be held at two locations, the Humane Society of Tampa Bay and Yingling, and will offer pet adoptions, food and drinks, and festivities. The event, sponsored by Tico Energy, aims to encourage the community to give of its abundant love for animals by promoting and facilitating adoptions of homeless pets during the holiday season. So again, that's this Saturday, November 21st. Two locations, the Humane Society of Tampa Bay, 3607 North Armenia Avenue in Tampa, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. And also at Yingling, I think the former name used to be Yingling Brewery. I don't know if they dropped the brewery part, but anyway, that's at 11111 North 30th Street in Tampa, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. there. So lots of rescue groups, vendors, food trucks, and more. And to get more details, you can go to its own website for the event now, petacopia.com. So pet-a-copia.com for details. And Thanksgiving right around the corner, of course. Florida Voices for Animals will host Tampa Bay's 10th annual Thanks Vegan Feast, a delicious potluck-style harvest feast open to all on Thanksgiving Day from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tampa in Temple Terrace. Share your favorite festive vegan dish and feast on a cornucopia of home-cooked dishes brought by hundreds of folks who prefer stuffed squash to a stuffed bird. For more information, go to thanksvegan.com or simply email thanksvegan@gmail.com. That will do it, I think, for today's edition of Animal News and Announcements. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a brand spanking new Talking Animals t-shirt to the first person who, instead of calling today, don't call today, we're doing it a little differently, so email us, Duncan, at WMNF.org and correctly identify this animal tune. Let's name that animal tune on Talking Animals. Again, if you can name that animal tune, today we're doing it not by phone. Don't call in. It won't count, I'm afraid. Email Duncan at WMNF.org, and we'll respond to you post-haste or thereabouts. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lawyer is up next with what amounts to 2 hours of radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, November 25th, with yet another edition of Talking Animals. I hope you'll join me for that. I also hope you visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow us on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news, scintillating news no less, from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. As usual, we're closing out today's show with an animal song, but this one's instrumental, folks. From the Buena Vista Social Club. It's a piece called Black Chicken 37 on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Watch and beyond. Community Conscious Radio, thanks for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.